At the dawn of the 20th century, with new fandangled technology, it allowed us here on the third rock from the sun to reach further into space than ever before and see things out there that we've never seen before, like life on Mars, or at least so it seemed from here. As Alexander Graham Bell put it, Mars is inhabited by a highly civilized and intelligent race of beings. Really? What brought the likes of Alexander Graham Bell and others in his age to believe that Mars was teeming with life, evolved life, civilized life? Well, that is the focus of the new book from our next guest, David Barron. He's a former NPR science correspondent and former science editor for The World, which you'll hear later today on WPR News coming up at 2 o'clock. He's also written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times. His last book was the best-selling American Eclipse. His new book, The Martians, the true story that captured turn-of-the-century America. David Barron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lee. I appreciate the kind introduction.
And I also want to invite you to the conversation and question about what leads us to believe what we do, how science leads us to draw conclusions, and the scientific method itself, which has been called into question by some using it to their own purposes in this new book. And we'll get to that. If you have a question for our guest, David Barron, join us at any point. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. David Barron, what brings a science journalist to the story of the Martians, the Mars, I don't know what you want to call it, the Mars boom at the turn of the 20th century?
Excellent question, because, yeah, I mean, I cover serious science, not frivolous things like Martians, but it all stems from my childhood. You know, I'm a child of the 1960s, and I grew up with Martians. They seem to be everywhere in popular culture. On Bugs Bunny cartoons, there was Marvin the Martian. There was a popular sitcom back then called My Favorite Martian. There were Martians in comics and Martians in science fiction. And having grown up and become a science reporter and an author who writes about astronomy, I was curious to know where that all started. What is it about Mars that it has this special place in our cultural consciousness? And so I started to do some research looking at starting with newspapers at the turn of the last century. You quoted some of those headlines. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely astonished to find that, you know, not that long before I was born, 60 years before I was born, Martians were not staples of science fiction. They were thought to be scientific fact by the most serious people.
What brought us at this point to believe in a common, with a common sense that would put us in the newspapers of the time, in the headlines of the time, to begin to believe that there are people just like us populating Mars?
Well, it's a complex story, and it's, you know, it's both a story about what astronomers were seeing on Mars, and it's a story about what was happening on Earth and why people really wanted to believe that there was a civilization on Mars. So to start with the first part, you know, by the late 19th century, astronomers were using excellent telescopes, large telescopes, to look at Mars. Mars comes near Earth, well, relatively near, every couple of years. And whenever Mars would swing past the Earth, astronomers would train their telescopes on it, and they could see the surface of the planet, and it looked sort of Earth-like. It has dark patches and light patches that they assumed were oceans and continents. But there was the whole idea of life on Mars, civilized life on Mars, began with an astronomer in Italy named Giovanni Schiaparelli, who in 1877 created a map of Mars, the most detailed yet. And he was seeing a network of extremely fine straight lines crisscrossing the planet that he imagined were waterways of some sort. And he called them canali, which in Italian means channels. Well, it was promptly mistranslated into English as canals, suggesting that they were artificial. People knew that it was a mistranslation, so that by itself was not what explains what happened. But it was another astronomer who came along named Percival Lowell in 1894 who decided he was going to focus on Mars. And he's the one who said that those lines really were canals, not for shipping, but for irrigation. And that's how it all started.
Percival Lowell is an interesting story, especially for those who are familiar with out east, because as I understand it from your book, David Barron, the Lowell, Massachusetts, was named after Percival Lowell's family.
Correct. Yes. So the Lowells of Massachusetts, they were an extremely prominent, wealthy family back in the 19th century. They really were involved in the very beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. They had textile factories in what became the city of Lowell, Massachusetts. The Lowells were great philanthropists, supporting Harvard University, helped in the creation of MIT. The first editor of the Atlantic Monthly was a Lowell. The Lowells were just very much a part of society. And so Percival Lowell, he graduated from Harvard, like all the men in the family. He graduated in 1876. He had plenty of money. He could do anything he wanted with his life. First, he became a writer. He traveled the world, particularly in Asia, and wrote books and articles about Asian cultures. But he was also interested in science, and he heard about these strange lines on Mars that Giovanni Schiaparelli had seen. He read a speculation of other astronomers about the possibility of life on Mars, and he became fixated on solving the mystery of Mars. And so in 1894, Percival Lowell used his considerable wealth to establish a new private observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. It's still there, the Lowell Observatory. Mm-hmm. He installed a large, excellent telescope, and he started mapping Mars. And he saw those strange lines that Schiaparelli saw. He saw even more of them. They looked, they were so straight. It was hard to believe that they were natural. And again, he came up with this theory that Mars was a dying planet. It was running out of water. And the only water left was in the polar ice caps, which you actually can see looking through a telescope. And so each spring in each hemisphere, when the ice cap melted, the water, he said, was brought by these channels, these canals, these irrigation ditches, down to the Martian farms and cities in the more temperate zone to the planet. And it was an elaborate theory that started out as kind of an interesting hypothesis, but over time he was able to convince more and more people that this, in fact, was true.
Was Percival Lowell an astronomer?
Well, so he was not a professional astronomer, but this was a time when astronomy was just starting to professionalize. There were a lot of prominent astronomers in the 19th century who really had no formal training. They were gentlemen astronomers who may have been lawyers or doctors or merchants who in later life decided to use some of their wealth and their free time to study the stars and the planets. So Percival Lowell was not a professional astronomer, but in this tradition of gentlemen astronomers, he was not dismissed either.
Now, part of your book, David Baron, is you actually going through some of these places, like going to Flagstaff, like trying to see what Percival Lowell saw that would lead him to believe there were huge irrigation channels throughout the planet of Mars. How did, in your experiences in following Percival's path here, how is it that he was able to make these conclusions? Is there some logic to what he was saying, considering the technology of the time?
There is a lot of logic, and I really tried as much as possible to put myself in the mind frame of people of that era. I mean, it's so easy to laugh today and say, this is ridiculous. How could anyone believe it?
Mm-hmm.
But we all know what Mars looks like. We have high-resolution images beamed back by the NASA rovers. We know that Mars doesn't have canals, doesn't have cities. But back then, all that people knew about Mars is what they could see through an Earth-bound telescope. And looking through even an excellent telescope from the surface of the Earth, you have to look through the Earth's atmosphere, which distorts what you see. So if even under excellent conditions, Mars will tend to wobble and go in and out of focus. It's hard to make out the fine details. And so these lines on Mars, they were at the very limit of perception. You didn't see them all the time. In fact, a lot of people never saw them. You had to stare at Mars for hours on end to start to see this network of so-called canals. So, it really was a mystery. And it was not, I don't think it was a ridiculous idea to think that Mars might have life, might in fact have intelligent life. But it sort of ended up taking on a life of its own. And by the early part of the 20th century, it just completely took over society. Martians were everywhere.
And that's until you get to the Yerkes Observatory in Lake Geneva, which plays a prominent role in this story. But before we get there, I want to ask you a little bit more about these channels and canals that Percival Lowell saw through the telescope on Mars and what he perceived them to be. The reality of these channels and canals, if they were actually on Mars, would have been massive in scope, David.
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about canals thousands of miles long. Now, a common criticism of Lowell's theory was, well, these canals must be miles and miles wide in order to see them from Earth. But Lowell said, actually, the lines themselves were not, what you were seeing from Earth was not the water, but on the rather, it was vegetation on the banks of the canals that would green up in the spring and then decay in the fall. And this fit with one of the great mysteries is that these lines on Mars were not always there. They tended to appear in the spring and summer in each hemisphere and then go away in the fall and winter. And so, again, this was one of the mysteries. Well, how could these lines come and go? Well, if it was plant life growing in the warmer seasons and then shedding leaves the rest of the year, well, that explained it. So, again, it was a logical theory.
David, who are some of the others of their age who began to believe in life on Mars and accept it as fact?
Well, you mentioned Alexander Graham Bell. Another genius inventor was Nikola Tesla. So Tesla, who is responsible for our modern system of electrical power generation and distribution, he was a true genius and was a celebrity in the 1890s. After doing work with the distribution of electricity by wires, he got interested in wireless, which today we call radio. Back then, the idea was, could you send telegraph signals through the air? And so Tesla was a pioneer in this area. Well, in 1899, he went to Colorado and established an experimental laboratory to study the wireless transmission of electricity. And he would listen on his radio receiver to see if he could hear anything. Now, there were no radio stations. No one was sending out signals artificially. But he would listen for natural things like lightning, which creates crackles and pops that you can hear in a radio receiver. And one night, alone in the laboratory, he heard the strangest signal. It was repeated in triplets. It was this very quiet click, 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 over and over again. And he could not come up with any natural explanation. And he decided that, well, this must be Lowell's Martians signaling the Earth, shouting hello. And when Tesla announced this to the press, the public just went wild. That's when the Martians really invaded popular culture.
The quote from your book, David, I have it right here. I have an instrument by which I can receive with precision any signal that might be made to this world from Mars. In the words of Nikola Tesla. It is part of David Barron's new book, The Martians, the true story that captured turn-of-the-century America at a time when people began to believe it was commonplace that there were civilizations like ours on Mars just waiting to meet with us. And with the advent of the wireless radio, which you're listening to right now, it appeared clear that it would be in due time that we would be communicating with these civilizations on Mars. What happened to this story from there? That's next when we continue with our guest, David Barron, former NPR science correspondent, and with you along for the ride at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Miller Show. Coming up at noon today on The Larry Miller Show, we take a look into the night sky with Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest this hour is David Barron, former NPR science correspondent, journalist, author of the best-selling American Eclipse, and the new The Martians, the true story that captured turn-of-the-century America. And I have my first correction for the day, and I want to thank my friends in Williams Bay, Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, not in Lake Geneva, and thank you for that clarification. David Barron, where were we? We were with the, and this to me is because maybe when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. To me, it's the radio that gives us the opportunity to have a technology to make a connection to Mars. To me, it's the technology that is happening on Earth that helps explain why we are all of a sudden connecting ourselves or looking to connect beyond our planet. That it wasn't just Tesla talking about connecting with Mars, but it was also the guy we most commonly give credit for inventing the radio we know today. Marconi is involved in this story as well.
Yeah, so Marconi, he was skeptical that that Tesla really received signals from Mars. But Marconi and Tesla were battling it out at that time about who would successfully create the first radio network, which again at the time was really for telegraphy. It was not really for sending out voice. But Tesla, I mean, Tesla was quite serious about communicating with the Martians. He was able to raise a fair amount of money from J.P. Morgan, the investment banker on Wall Street, who funded the establishment of this giant tower on Long Island that was going to be the first of a whole network of such towers that Tesla wanted to create across the globe to connect the planet with itself through wireless, mm-hmm. but then also to be able to communicate with the Martians.
But today we sit here with antennas around the globe connecting all of us through radio. So that was something that was well before its time. But what became of that Long Island antenna, David?
Well, so the story of Nikola Tesla, it's quite a sad one because, yeah. I mean, he really was a genius who changed the world. And he was a visionary. He really wanted to use technology to make the world better. But he was not a very good businessman. And he went broke. And his talk about Mars and other things, people started to see him as kind of flaky. And so his investors backed out. And his tower on Long Island never really did get off the ground. And eventually it was reduced to rubble for scrap in 1917 when he was broke and had to pay his debts.
Sold for parts. And so let's go now to the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay next to Lake Geneva and the August 1909 gathering of astronomers. Now, to put this in context, we had the Wright brothers giving aviation and flight another new technology around 1908. So around a year later, the astronomers gather at Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin, and they've got some questions about Percival Lowell's science about Mars.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's in writing about the Martians, it's amazing how it connects with everything else. The Wright brothers, who, of course, had their first flight in 1903, but it really wasn't until 1908 that people understood that they had solved the problem of motorized flight. The attempt to reach the North Pole figures in what was happening in newspapers at the time. Yeah. At the time, the building of the Panama Canal, it all connects with the Martians. And a lot of it has to do with the excitement about what was happening on Earth. The technology seemed to make it possible to do anything. And in this spirit of anything is possible, was it really so crazy to think that there were Martians on Mars that we could communicate with? Well, a number of more serious astronomers did question that. And they thought that Percival Lowell had really gotten ahead of his skis, that, you know, okay, it was an interesting theory, but there were more and more doubts coming in, including the fact that a lot of astronomers didn't see these lines, these canals on Mars. And they were questioning if, in fact, they were nothing more than optical illusions. And so the American Astronomical Society, that's what it's called today, it had a slightly different name back then, met at Yerkes in 1909 and decided to put out a statement on behalf of American astronomers to the press saying that any discussion of talking to Mars is basically ridiculous at this time, and we are not promoting anyone investing in some scheme to talk to the Martians. In fact, there was a Harvard astronomer who had said, "Well, one way to communicate with the Martians would be to build an entire farm of mirrors, miles wide and deep, that we could flash sunlight at the Martians, basically Morse code." And these ideas were just getting so ridiculous that the astronomical community felt it had to push back. And that's what they did at the Yerkes Observatory that year.
David Barron, could you see the lines on Mars when you looked through these telescopes? Were you able to understand what Percival Lowell saw and at the same time what the other astronomers were concerned about and when it came to the scientific method of astronomy?
Well, I should say that even today, people who observe Mars will sometimes see these strange lines come and go. I did not see them. I did go to the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. I looked through Lowell's very telescope in 2018 when Mars made an extremely close approach to Earth. So basically, I was looking at Mars through the same telescope that Lowell used pretty much when Mars was where it was in the sky when he looked in 1894. Unfortunately, Mars has a tendency once in a while to be to have these global dust storms that blow across the entire planet and throw up so much dust that you can't see the surface anymore. And unfortunately, that was true when I went and used this telescope. I could not see the surface features. It was just, it looked like a giant apricot in the sky. It was sort of this reddish orange. It was impressive to see through the telescope, but I did not see the canals.
Where else did your research take you for this book? I know about the search for Alianza in South America.
Yeah, so that's kind of the climax of the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, people went to such extremes to try to figure out what was happening on Mars. And kind of the climax of the book is in 1907, when, so Percival Lowell, again, who was the main proponent of this idea about the canals on Mars. Now, this was a time when he was basically putting out these hand-drawn maps showing all these lines, and people could question, well, is your eyesight right? Have you drawn these correctly?
Well, right, there's no photographs at this time. That's something else to point out that we didn't have. I mean, there were photographs, but we didn't have the capacity to take photographs of what we were seeing through these telescopes.
Well, except that Lowell then figured out a way to do it. And so he was able, he had his assistants come up with new technology to take photographs of Mars through a telescope. Now, these were tiny photographs, a quarter inch across, tiny grainy photographs, but they were quite a revelation at the time. And people could see that, yeah, Mars did have dark areas and light areas. And if you kind of squint, maybe you could see lines too. So in 1907, when Mars was going to make its closest approach to Earth in 15 years, but would be better seen from the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere, Lowell used his personal fortune to pay an astronomer at Amherst College in Massachusetts to basically disassemble the college's 7-ton telescope, pack it into 119 boxes, put those into crates, put them onto a ship down to Panama. The Panama Canal was not yet built, so they had to put it on a train over the isthmus onto another ship on the west coast of Central and South America, went down to northern Chile, up into the Atacama Desert, one of the driest places on Earth. And that's where David Todd, this astronomer from Amherst, reassembled his telescope to point it at Mars and to take over 10,000 photographs of the planet during its close approach. And both David Todd and Percival Lowell then portrayed that evidence as absolute proof that the canals were real and that the Martian civilization was real. And by then, people had been hearing about it so long that they bought it. And so by 1908, and I have this in my book, you have pastors in church sermonizing about the Martian civilization and how we should, I haven't talked about the civilization itself, but it was thought to be a peaceful civilization. And the idea was we should emulate the Martians. We should try to be a better world like Mars is.
Yeah, I am fascinated with the psychology of how we were projecting or our aspirations were put on another planet, or we were trying to find something about ourself way, way out there in space, David.
Right. Well, so you know, the most famous Martians from that era are those in H.G. Wells' book, The War of the Worlds. Right. And so his Martians, of course, were these disgusting creatures that came to Earth and marched across the planet in these giant tripods, hunting down humans as prey. They wanted to take over our planet. But the remarkable thing is, even though that was written at that time out of all that excitement about Mars, that was not what people thought the real Martians were like. They thought the real Martians were these peaceful, moral beings. After all, if the Martians were able to survive on a planet that was running out of water, and the only way they could survive was by running this global network of irrigation canals, well, that meant the entire planet was working as one, that there were no, you know, there clearly was no war, there was no division of politics, everyone was coming together for this common good. And so the planet that Mars was named after, the god of war, and yet it was seen as a planet of peace. And the hope was that we could learn how to be more peaceful if we would only get in touch with the Martians.
Talk a little bit about what became of Nikola Tesla and what became of Percival Lowell as the years went on. And you mentioned David Todd going down to Alianza. What became of the likes of David Todd and other scientists who bought into the idea that Mars was populated hook, line, and sinker?
Well, so it's a very complex and interesting story. You have these people who were really riding high for quite a while. You know, Percival Lowell was probably the most famous astronomer in America. You know, he was getting front page coverage in all the newspapers. So by, you know, I mentioned when David Todd went down to Chile in 1907 and came back with these photographs, by the end of 1907, the Wall Street Journal, perhaps the most sober newspaper in America, said the biggest news of the year was proof of intelligent life on Mars. Wow. That's how well accepted it was. So David Todd and Percival Lowell were definitely riding high. They were, you know, Lowell saw himself as the next Charles Darwin. Darwin had explained evolution of life on Earth. Lowell was taking that idea out to the planets. Well, as the scientific community, you know, doubts were raised, questions were asked about whether, in fact, the lines were really there. By 1909, when Mars made another close approach, there were astronomers who really thought that, in the end, what Lowell was seeing was nothing more than optical illusions. Well, Lowell, who had staked his very identity on this idea, was not willing to back down at all. And he just dug his heels in and became sort of more and more delusional, and David Todd as well over the years. But Percival Lowell, to his dying day, he died quite suddenly of a brain aneurysm in 1916. Up until his death, he was still as sure as ever that the Martians were there and that someday he would be vindicated. So it's kind of a sad story. Yeah. You have these people who
believed
they believed something that was wrong. They took Earth down this dead end. And yet it's actually a very inspiring story in a lot of ways. And that's one of the reasons I liked writing the book, because it has a very complex set of lessons.
Right. But this is where your book started, David, was, you know, being a child of the 60s and being surrounded by these stories of Martians and outer space and life in outer space, and following that to its origin story, which is a very real story about science, about the media, and about belief.
And right, and about imagination. Oh. That Percival Lowell, he sparked something that was actually very positive. That Mars craze at the turn of the last century is what spawned science fiction as we know it today. The early science fiction writers, you probably heard about the Hugo Awards, these big literary awards in science fiction. They're named after Hugo Gernsback, who was a pioneering editor of science fiction. Hugo Gernsback said he became a science fiction editor and writer because as a child, he read one of Percival Lowell's books about Mars and got so excited about the possibility of life on another planet that that's what he devoted his life to thinking about. The early rocket scientist, Robert H. Goddard, who's called the father of American rocketry, he built the first liquid-fueled rocket. He got inspired because he read H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds when he was a teen and wondered, could we actually go to Mars? How would we get there? And there are so many stories like this, and I have them in my book, of the ways in which that excitement at the turn of the last century inspired the kids of the time who grew into the adults who would actually launch us toward outer space.
Carl Sagan, Arthur C. Clarke.
Right.
David Barron.
Well, Carl Sagan, you know, was not alive at the turn of the last century, but he grew up on these Mars books by Edgar Rice Burroughs, who's more famous for his Tarzan books. But Edgar Rice Burroughs, inspired by Lowell, wrote a series of books about John Carter's adventures on Mars, a planet that the Martians themselves called Barsoom. And those were hugely popular through the 20s and 30s and 40s. And Carl Sagan grew up on those books and said it was because of those books that he wanted to go to Mars. He wanted to go to Barsoom. And even though he couldn't get there himself, he helped to build the spacecraft that did get to Mars, and we could figure out the truth of what's there.
It is amazing, and it brings us to where we are today, because we do have Mars in our sights once again. And there are those who would like to take us there, and there are those who aren't necessarily astronomers who believe we can get there from here. But how do we take the lessons learned from David Barron's new book, The Martians, and apply them to the world we see today, where the same people who are writing the big, bold headlines happen to be building the rocket ships that may one day take us to the red planet? It is an interesting story for introspection, not because of what it was, but because of what it is right now. Our guest, David Barron, is a former NPR science correspondent, a journalist. His last book was the best-selling The American Eclipse. His new book, The Martians, the true story that captured turn-of-the-century America. And if you have a question about it, we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Miller Show. Tomorrow here on Garden Talk, we'll talk about which plants to cut back and which to leave before winter sets in for real. Diana Alfith returns, retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. After that, we talk to James Card, author of the book Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk here on The Larry Miller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest this hour is David Barron, former NPR science correspondent and author of the new book, The Martians. We've been taking a look at the turn of the 20th century and how some came to believe and became common sense for many that there was not just life on Mars, but a peaceful civilization working in unity. David, and we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David Barron, what surprised you about your research into the Martians?
Oh, gosh, so much. Again, I, you know, some of your listeners may have heard about the canals on Mars. You know, when I was a kid, there was still this thought that there were these weird lines on Mars. The idea persisted well into the 20th century, and although people didn't think they were really canals by then, and I knew a little bit about Percival Lowell, but I had no idea the extent to which this really became so much a part of our culture. I mean, the Martians, you know, by the early 1900s, you could find them in Broadway shows and vaudeville skits and Tin Pan Alley songs, and they were in advertising. There was a comic strip character named Mr. Skygak from Mars who was popular at the time. The Martians were just everywhere.
Was it common knowledge then? Did folks walk around the streets saying, well, when the Martians get here, or when we finally get a chance to find out what the Martians eat, was it just accepted around the early 1900s that it was imminent that we would meet the Martians?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, no one, as far as I know, did a careful poll of what people thought. I'm sure there were still plenty of skeptics, but there was a lot of belief, too. And the remarkable thing is the extent to which people wanted to believe in the Martians. So, again, the idea was this was an advanced civilization that was more peaceful, more moral than we are. And the hope was that they would kind of be our saviors, our guardian angels. My book is filled with depictions of Martians, and some of them show the Martians with wings and looking down over the Earth as if they are our guardian angels. And there's, by 1909, when there was discussion again of getting in touch with the Martians, about trying to communicate with them, there was this newspaper article that ran in many newspapers across the country, and it was headlined "Questions Mars Might Answer." And so you might think, well, getting in touch with the Martians, well, we'd want to know practical things. How do we make a better airplane? How do we build better canals, right?
Sure.
The questions for the Martians were the most deeply existential questions. Where does the soul go when you die?
Wow.
How can we prevent human suffering?
Huh.
What is the right way to live? These were the questions for the Martians. There was a spirituality about it that, you know, science for so long had been undermining, you know, the general tenets of Christian belief from Galileo to Newton to Darwin. It seemed that science could explain the workings of nature, and where was God in all of this? Well, now science had given the people these new kinds of gods, the Martians next door, who might be able to answer our deepest questions.
It sounds aspirational. Again, it feels like there's a huge psychological component here, David Barron, and I know you're a science correspondent, but what is it about our own mind that leads us to want to believe?
Well, so my book is called The Martians, but it really is about the humans.
Yes.
It is. It's about us and why we believe what we believe and how we can so easily fool ourselves. Mm. You know, there the the eye can trick the brain can trick itself. An idea that one person has can spread to others. Percival Lowell saying that he saw this network of canals was made it more likely that others would see the same canals, even if they were nothing more than optical illusions. This is a lesson very much present today.
And as a journalist, I start, then you would have to think about these things too. All the biases that we have to fight against in order to bring the story to fruition, those biases seem to play a central role in all of the things that are happening here in your book.
Right, and it was happening in journalism too. I write a lot about what was happening with newspapers. It was the rise of what was called the yellow press. Today we would call it the tabloid press, but William Randolph Hearst in particular was changed newspapers, seizing on the most sensationalistic things to cover. Well, he loved the Martians. He and Joseph Pulitzer, who were going at it for as many readers as they could get, that figured in. So it started with the tabloid press, but then eventually made it into the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. So ideas really do have a way of spreading almost like viruses.
So David Baron, that brings us to today, the turn of the 21st century, and a refocusing on whether or not, not just to look at Mars, but to visit Mars, maybe create a habitat on Mars. How do you see your book, The Martians, as it applies to what's happening in our world and our astronomy today?
Yeah, I think there are really interesting echoes of what I write about in my book that we can hear today. So it's no secret that Elon Musk, the richest man on Earth, is quite serious that he would like to colonize Mars. He has done, like him or hate him, he has done remarkable things in terms of rocketry and making it more affordable to get into space and perhaps even to start sending rockets to Mars on a regular basis. But the way he talks about it sounds a lot like the way people talked about Mars back over a century ago. That Mars, again, it's not just Elon Musk. There's a whole group called the Mars Society of folks who really want to jumpstart a new human future on Mars. And the idea is we're going to start over. We're going to do it better. We're going to create a more perfect world on Mars and leave behind the troubles of Earth. That sounds a lot like what people were saying about Mars back then. Mm-hmm. Mars is a better world that we want to emulate. We want to become. And I think that's a little crazy. I'm all for trying to get to Mars. I would love to see astronauts on Mars in my lifetime. But the idea that somehow we're going to start over there and leave our troubles behind, I think is going a bit too far. It's we're imagining what we want to be true as opposed to what is true, which is Mars is the most dreadful place. Mars wants to kill you in 100 different ways. It's going to be very hard to live there. I would love to see some astronauts get to Mars in my lifetime. I actually agree with Elon Musk that if in the long term, meaning millions, billions of years, if in the long run our civilization is to survive, we do need to spread out from Earth. But it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to be easy.
Yes, you are a science journalist, and what do the scientists say about what it would take to put people on Mars?
Well, again, NASA's goal has been to put people on Mars for decades now. It always seems to be 15 years in the future. Mm-hmm. It is possible. We will be able to send people there. But then you've got these other ideas about terraforming Mars, turning Mars into another Earth. We know now that several billion years ago, Mars had a thicker atmosphere. Mars was warmer. Mars had flowing water. Could we turn Mars back into a more Earth-like planet? Well, that is maybe possible, but that's going to be the work of many, many, many generations. I do think we could get, in my lifetime, we could, and if we don't get there, meaning the United States, I think the Chinese will get there before us.
Wow. So there is a Mars race and it is underway already.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so when we look at the future, then what can we apply from the Martians in your book, David, that would give us a roadmap to go forward that wouldn't lead us astray, that wouldn't have us buying into less sound science, that would give us the best path towards actual sound science and the future of astronomy?
Well, so I think there are a few lessons. I mean, one is the importance of skepticism, and not just skepticism of others, but of skepticism about ourselves. You know, I've been out on a book tour this fall, and it's not uncommon when I give a talk that I get questions about UFOs. I don't claim to be an expert on UFOs or UAPs or whatever people want to call them today. I very much believe that there must be life out there somewhere. I'm not convinced that it's come here, but I can't say it hasn't. But what I do ask people is, you know, for those who are really skeptical, say, of that the government is hiding things from us, that, you know, that there are, that there was an alien autopsy, that sort of thing. Well, you know, it's good to be skeptical, but you have to be skeptical of yourself too. We can so easily convince ourselves that things are true that are not true because we so want them to be true. We have to be as skeptical of ourselves as we are of others. I think that's an important lesson.
Well, then let me turn this on you, David Barron, because as I look out into space and I see what appears to be infinity before me, and we are deeper and further now than we have ever been before, the thing that I don't find out there, the rarest thing in this universe as far as we can find, is life. So what makes David Barron, the science correspondent and journalist, believe that there must be science out there? Why aren't you skeptical of that belief when we look out there, it is the thing we're least likely to find?
It's a very good question, and I would say you should be skeptical of me. I admit 100% that I want there to be life out there. I find it comforting to believe that we're part of some intergalactic network of life, and that even when the Earth is no longer here, that life will continue.
Yeah.
I want to believe that. So I acknowledge that I am biased. But at the same time, you know, we know that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. And we now know that most stars have planets around them. More than 5,000 planets have now been discovered around other stars. Some of them, it appears, are probably habitable. That doesn't mean they're inhabited, but habitable. It just from the math, you have to think that how likely is it that we are the only ones? On the other hand, if we are the only ones, of course, you know, we're the only ones to think that. So there's
right.
I'm not making really a very good argument.
But it's a belief. That's why it's hard to make an argument, because it's a leap of faith. A leap of faith you want to make because it provides an opportunity for us collectively to be better. The same aspirational leap of faith we saw when we looked at the face of Mars. We hear when we hear people talking about trying to colonize Mars, that there is a better self in there somewhere. And even if our science leads us astray, and even if the powerful few with the resources to change the way we see things or challenge our perceptions, even with those, that aspiration, even if it's misplaced, can lead towards something better for us and a better self ultimately. That's kind of the way I took from what I took from your book, David, and applied it to what we see today, that even if Elon Musk is going down a path of Percival Lowell, that the generations to come may benefit from it.
Absolutely. I mean, it is imagination that pushes us forward. And, you know, and science can only go so far, and science is you know, trying to answer the next mysteries. And to answer those mysteries, imagination is very helpful to try to figure out, well, what could explain the unexplained? At some point, if the data comes in and it shows that your idea was wrong, you have to be willing to accept that. But to imagine what is beyond our current state of knowledge is, I think, that's what pushes us forward as a civilization. That's what makes us want to explore.
Seems to be two different tracks here, David Barron. One would be the scientific method, which would we adhere to understand the world around us. The other one would be our aspirations, which we can apply to the world around us to try to find a better path forward.
Well, even Albert Einstein, there's a famous quote that I won't get right, but Albert Einstein talked about that imagination is critical to science and more important than knowledge, he said. Imagination to try to figure out the unknown.
What's the reaction been like so far from your book, The Martians?
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, I've been thrilled by the reviews it's gotten and the best of lists that it's on. But it's just been a lot of fun giving talks and, you know, hearing people's excitement about Mars and young folks today who dream of going to Mars. You know, that Mars is still very, very much a part of our culture.
It is still part of our aspirations. It is still something that I think we're all projecting on to some degree. What's David Baron working on these days?
I am taking a break. This book took 7 years to write.
Wow.
I had no idea it would take that long. But I ended up collecting thousands and thousands of newspaper articles about the Martians and going through archives from Arizona to Washington, D.C. to Paris to Milan. It took a lot of work. It was a lot of fun. But before I launch into another big project like that, I need to take a break.
Do you have any indication or direction of where you may be investigating next? What are some of your curiosities? What questions do you have?
Well, I've so enjoyed writing about the history of astronomy. You mentioned my previous book, American Eclipse, which is the true story of a total solar eclipse that crossed America's Wild West in 1878, attracted many of the great scientists of the day. Thomas Edison was in Wyoming for that eclipse, an all-female expedition from Vassar went to Denver. I love writing these stories, and I might say that that book, American Eclipse, has actually been turned into a musical.
What?
That hopefully will get to Broadway by 2028. Yeah, it's a wonderful musical. And so I just so enjoy digging up these stories of forgotten characters and important events at the time that we've forgotten. That still resonate today.
Well, now all of a sudden I'm giddy about the thought of the possibility of The Martians, the musical.
Well, in some way, I think it's a more obvious
right.
one. You can imagine having a lot of fun with the costuming on stage.
With the telescopes and maybe Percival Lowell and tracking that 7-ton telescope through South America. That would make quite a song, I would believe, David. I really appreciate where you're going with all this because I do see it as a story about not just what happened, but what appears to be happening again and what will probably cycle through again just because of the human nature and how we see the rest of the world, David. And I want to thank you for showing it through your eyes.
Well, thank you. And I would just say, I mean, my idea about science writing is science, like anything, is really about people. And my goal is always to tell stories about interesting people and places and plots. And yeah, so even if you don't think you're interested in science, I hope that the book will still appeal to you.
Absolutely. And what is it about public radio that does that to us? It ends up, no matter what it is, it's always about people. It always boils down to relationships, and it always comes down to a very interpersonal level. So this time I've had with you, David, I've appreciated it immensely, and thank you so much for your good book, and can't wait to see what book or what musical comes out of your work next. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lee. It was a lot of fun.
David Baron's a former NPR science journalist, correspondent. He was the science editor for The World, which you will hear coming up today at 2 here on WPR News. His best-selling book, American Eclipse, check that out. And that was the late 19th century. And then at the advent of the 20th century, his new book, The Martians, the true story that captured turn-of-the-century America. We thank him very much for joining us. And we'll move on from the idea of the Martians, the aspirational aspect of Mars, to the real stars and planets that are moving around our solar system. Actually, we're moving through it. And yet there are comets that people have some questions about. There are the northern lights, which are reaching all the way down into southern United States. And there is the vast universe that seems infinite around us. What can we gain from it? What aspirations do we have? How do we apply the scientific method to better understand it? And how do we stay skeptical of that which is yet to be proven? We will take a look at our skies with avid amateur astronomer Paul Kinzer when we continue. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. And we'll invite you to the conversation as well. What questions do you have about what you're seeing in your night sky? That's when we continue here on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is WPR News. space, the final frontier. That's where we're going next. Paul Kinzer, our guest, member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, and a longtime amateur astronomer himself. He's the author of the book Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. And if you've got questions about our night skies, our planets, our celestial beings, you can give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. And Paul Kinzer, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, I'm always glad to come.
Yeah, I was telling our last guest, when I look out in the night sky, the one thing that strikes me, and it is very introspective, and it does become very self-centered, is that the one thing out there that I do not see as far as I can look and as far as we've gone is life. It seems to be the rarest thing in the universe.
It seems that way, but I don't believe it's rare, because we now know we've learned so much in the last few decades. We now know that there are planets around other stars. We didn't know that when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s. In fact, we now know that on average, every star has a planet, at least one planet. So there are literally trillions upon trillions of planets in the universe. I can't believe that there isn't somewhere that not only has life, but that has intelligent thinking, making creatures.
Statistically speaking, we are not alone.
Yeah.
The reality of it, however...
Right. We haven't found any yet.
Right. But it's not that we should stop looking, because the statistics would suggest if we keep looking, we will find something eventually. And we have seen indications of water, the components of life, carbon, that it would just take something... I don't know what it would be, the element that makes it all come together to give us what we are right now.
Right. We are not going to find intelligent life on Mars or anywhere else in the solar system. We've explored it enough to know that. However, there are missions in space right now that are going out into the solar system to look for signs of life. This time not on Mars. That was our sort of high hope for the longest time. And it's not a dead hope. We may find, if not life, we may find the remains of life.
Artifacts,
on Mars.
Yeah.
Fossils, it's possible. I would even say that it's probable, in my opinion, because it's incontrovertible now. There was once liquid water on Mars.
There was an atmosphere there that was thicker than it stands today.
Yeah, and we have figured out why the atmosphere went away. It went away because of the solar wind, the little bits that the sun spits off, and they hit our atmosphere too, but gravity is strong enough here to hold on to our oxygen. I believe it was the probe from India that is, I think, still in orbit around Mars. They were able to see, to this day, parts of the atmosphere of Mars being blown away by solar particles.
Wow.
And it was too small to hold on to that atmosphere.
But we're big enough now where a solar wind isn't going to have anything like that effect.
And then the moons out at Saturn and Jupiter, we are pretty convinced they have vast oceans of liquid water under their frozen surfaces. And they, in fact, some of them are, they have more water than all the water on Earth. And because of the tides created by the giant planets they go around, that's why there is liquid water. The tides cause friction down beneath the surface that keeps things warm. And it may well be that there are things going on them that led to life.
Organisms?
Yeah. And one of the probes we sent out there is going to go through plumes that are being shot out of at least one of the moons, and maybe, in fact, the Cassini probe at Saturn, it did fly through some, and it found some traces of some maybes, but it wasn't sent there back in before the year 2000. It arrived in 2004. It was not designed to zip through the plumes from this moon, because it's the thing that discovered those plumes.
So, I didn't know it was there until it got there.
Yeah. So
it is an again, it is just an aspirational way to see the world that we're living in and this understanding that we're statistically speaking probably not alone, even if it feels that way right now.
Right.
Paul Kinzer, in the news recently has been this story of the 3i Atlas comet in the news recently because NASA had to come out just yesterday and say, this is not a spaceship.
Yeah.
Why did NASA have to come out, release pictures of this comet that is flying near us, and argue that this is not the mothership coming to take us home?
Because there are people who want it to be that. They want it to be the mothership so badly that they look at what evidence we have and they find reasons to claim what they claim. Has to do with the orbit, you know, how could it be zipping through here? The first one, you know, it's called 3i because it stands for third interstellar object. Mm-hmm. Well, the first interstellar object, it's got a name now, I can't remember what it was. It was shaped a lot like, well, maybe a lot like the Millennium Falcon. But
Han Solo come?
Yeah. But so this Harvard professor, his name is Avi Loeb. He wrote a paper and presented arguments about why he thought it was quite suspicious to think of this merely as a passing interstellar rock because of the way it was coming in and the way that it left and things like that. But others were able to quickly come up with arguments and reasons that did not it did not need little people or big people flying a spaceship. And then the second one came and he released another paper and the third one.
And this is the third one now.
This is the third one now. And he made that claim. And the thing is,
this is a Harvard astronomer.
Yeah.
And I am not even a backyard astronomer.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I buy what Avi Loeb is selling?
Well, and in your last hour, I think a big part of it is the times we live in and the technology we have.
Yes.
And one of those technologies is the internet. And so if he had made these claims 25, 30 years ago, it would not have reached nearly as wide an audience as it has. It might make the media, but it wouldn't be the thing it is now because there are people who really, really want this. And there are, all the media, they're like, ooh, this is a good story.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, hey, he's at Harvard and all that.
Right,
so,
there's credibility there. He's Ivy League.
Yeah.
And yet the NASA has been pretty insistent that this is just a comet that is coming nearby.
Yeah.
And we have improved our opportunities, abilities to actually see these nearby comets.
That's right. Now, the other thing is, it didn't come very close to Earth. We weren't able to get great pictures of it. In fact, one of our orbiters at Mars took pictures of it, which to me is pretty cool. You know, there are a lot of science fiction writers and speculative people who say when things from other stars do arrive, or if they ever do, they will probably be robots because, you know, look at that orbiter on Mars. It doesn't need air. It doesn't, you know, it's just a thing that someone built. We built it and it could just, you know, it's made for taking pictures of the Martian surface. They just have a turn around. Hey, there's a comet there. Take some pictures. I found that amazing. That's
so
pretty cool to me.
When we get to the possibility of other life coming to Earth, if we apply our own technology to that, it's likely that what we'll see first is machines, equally likely that we will mistake them for the actual aliens.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm not going out on that big a limb. Most really serious scientists would say the whole idea that we have been visited and are still being visited by anything from another star is very unlikely because of the speed of light.
Mm-hmm. That's like sort of a universal speed limit. That's about as fast as we can go. And when we're 500 to 1,000 light years away from something, that's going to take us 500 to 1,000 years to get there.
If we could ever get near the speed of light, which would be extremely difficult for, I won't go into the reasons because I don't quite understand relativity.
Neither did Einstein, so you're not alone.
Yeah, but it is a very difficult thing. I think another cool thing is, though, people have thought of ways that we could create ships, spaceships, that could get to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, in, you know, anywhere from 100 years down to 10 or 12 with kind of current technology. However,
wow.
One of those is to take a whole bunch of atomic bombs and let them out the back of the ship and blow them up to push the ship. And
your
have a
propulsion
big...
system is just...
Yeah, yeah. And
nuclear reactions?
Somebody came up with that in the 60s, I think kind of as a joke. But it's been studied a lot, and it would work.
Interesting. Yeah. As we look for life out there and the life that is here in our backyard. Take your questions now with our guest, Paul Kinzer from the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, author of Stargazing Basics. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Marcus in Green Bay now. Marcus, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's my understanding that there are satellites that can be controlled. They can be stationary instead of orbiting. I don't mean Starlink. So is that correct that, you know, some satellites can be moved to a place and remain stationary over the
Yes, not only that, they're extremely important satellites. That's where we get all of our, international news coverage and stuff. And they are in orbit, but they're at a place, and I'm not an orbital dynamicist, but these satellites are in a place far enough from Earth so that as they orbit the Earth, they go around the Earth in the same amount of time it takes the Earth to spin around once. It's called geostationary orbit. It's sometimes called the Clark orbit because science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke thought of it during World War II, before we had any idea that we were going to soon be up in space, and he lived to see communication satellites in that orbit.
These satellites have become part, at least in my experience, of our night sky viewing, Paul,
yeah.
And they have become tracers in the sky.
Yeah.
They have become, to some, congestion
yeah.
in the night sky.
Yeah, and those are not the geostationary ones. They're so far away and so small that unless you're taking an astro image of a very specific part of the sky, you're not going to see those. But there are now thousands upon thousands of low Earth orbit satellites. They need to go much more quickly. They need to go at least 17,000 miles an hour, or they'll fall back down to Earth. And when they do that, and they're up there, they're where the International Space Station is, they're where a lot of scientific satellites are. And what most of these are now, they're being launched here in the United States, they're being launched by SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, to allow people to communicate via the internet and cell phone all around the world. Now, I got in an argument a while ago with a guy where I said, I don't think we need these. We're fine without them. And he said, no, latency, the not tendency, but the lag of a signal being sent in the ways that we send them now are too long, and that people won't stand for them when they now know they don't need them. And I'm like, you know what? Almost no one's using these. So I don't buy it. I think there are more reasons to not do it than to do it. And again, there are people who don't agree with me, and that's up to them. But the other thing is, there's no regulation because he's not the only one doing it. There
right.
are other companies doing it. Jeff Bezos wants to do it. China is doing it. They're sending up thousands of satellites. There's a company in the UK that's doing it or hoping to do it. And it isn't just the satellites. The rocket launches themselves are leaving a lot of little bits of not nice stuff in the upper atmosphere. And nobody knows what that's going to do. Nobody is even looking at it seriously.
Well, you said would it have to keep going at 17,000 miles an hour or re-enter the atmosphere, burn
right.
up, or
and
crash?
They eventually do re-enter the atmosphere. And to give them credit, SpaceX has planned for that. And they try to take care to make sure that those are not harmful to humans by hitting the ground. But all of these satellites, when they hit the atmosphere, they have heavy metals in them and other things. Even aluminum little tiny bits of it getting in the atmosphere. There are scientists who are worried this may affect the atmosphere. And I'm not, again, I'm no expert. It's just, I think it's one of those things we're going into without thinking of the consequences strongly enough.
That maybe we should be thinking a little bit more about what's in our night skies before we just go ahead and put them up there.
Yeah. But astronomers are definitely not happy. We have several very large telescopes coming online soon, and this will affect their science. One of them is called the Vera Rubin telescope, named for a very important astronomer. Look her up. And it is a survey telescope that is the technology that makes it especially amazing is its data processing, because every stinking night it's going to be taking pictures, very detailed pictures of huge swaths of sky every few seconds. It's going to be creating petabytes of...
I don't even know what that is.
I can't remember
stop
either.
Terabytes.
Terabytes. petabytes, I think, is 1,000 terabytes. And it's going to be creating those, and they had to figure out, well, how do we even get that information onto some kind of storage device, and then how do we disseminate it? Anyway, that telescope is going to see all of these satellites every night. And they'll be able to come up with ways of subtracting that information, but it's not nice. It's not
still interference.
Thing. Yeah.
Where is this telescope going?
Thanks.
Sorry.
I believe it's one of the ones in the Atacama Desert, like that 7-ton telescope you talked about. Yeah. I believe it's in South America. And that's a great place for telescopes because it's so high and it's so dry. There's no rain there. But it's already taken some pictures, and in it, in its first few pictures, it discovered a bunch of asteroids.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No.
So we are already, this new telescope's already producing results in terms
of... It's in testing phase.
Would these be near-Earth asteroids?
Well, that's one of the things it's looking for.
Interesting.
But anything bright enough, it's going to see it.
So could the space junk, could the proliferation of satellites in our lower Earth orbit, could that get in the way of our opportunity to identify approaching celestial objects?
There are astronauts who are now saying it could soon get in the way of us even going up there. They just had to, China has its own space station. And they just had to either have the crew leave early or make them stay longer because they knew they were going to go through some space debris. They had to take evasive action.
Oh, and, interesting.
Yeah, and the International Space Station, they have systems for that too. When they know, we're going near here, let's boost our orbit a little bit or go a little bit lower for a little bit or whatever. There's a lot of stuff up there. And I can't remember the term, but there was a scientist who came up with if we reach this certain point and then of how many we have up there, and then one of them hits another, it could lead to a cascading effect of all sorts of them hitting each other. And then it could be years and years before we were be able to launch a rocket into space.
Space again, dominoes.
Yeah. And I don't know how realistic that is, but it's definitely being taken seriously.
Paul Kinzer, our guest, member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, author of the book Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, and here to answer your celestial questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us, talk@WPR.org. And when we continue, we'll take a look at the Aurora Borealis, which stretched all the way to Alabama last week. Are we seeing more of these sun storms? That's when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Did you get your WPR newsletter today? We only send it once a day, and by we, I mean our own Jenny Peek. You're never going to miss a story with a WPR daily newsletter. We're not going to bug you about it, but it's there for you each and every morning when you sign up at WPR.org/newsletters. It'll keep you informed and connected with stories you need to know and people you're going to want to meet. So sign up today at WPR.org/newsletters. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, our guest Paul Paul Kinzer as we look to the night skies and the celestial happenings out there and what it means for us back here at home. If you have astronomical questions, you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Paul, I heard that the Northern Lights reached all the way to Alabama last week. However, I did not see them. Did you?
I did. Members of my club wrote an email that night, and I just happened to be on the line at time, and someone just wrote, Northern Lights, now.
So, enough said.
Yeah, my wife and my son and I, we went into our backyard in our little town, and there they were. And we hadn't even had our eyes adjust to the darkness yet. If we had stayed out longer, we would have seen them much better. But, yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. And so what is it that made these lights go all the way to the southern states of the United States?
Well, the sun is a mass of incandescent gas. that's an old song. But it's very active. It's what gives us life on Earth, basically, the heat from it. I'm not going to go into all the science, but there are storms on the sun, not like rainstorms here on Earth, but magnetic storms where bits of the sun can get blown off the surface. And sometimes it's aimed at Earth when that happens.
Is this what happened to the atmosphere in Mars? Was it a solar storm that created the solar wind that blew the atmosphere off Mars?
The sun is always putting out bits of particles, and we call that the solar wind, because like blowing air, it is blowing bits. It's tiny, but it is enough over, you know, years and centuries and millions of years to do just that. And it wasn't necessarily solar storms that did it to Mars. It was just the constant, and still is, constant bombardment of these little particles that is still eroding Mars's very thin now atmosphere. And it didn't happen here. Well, it did happen here. We probably used to have way more hydrogen on Earth. Maybe, I don't know. But our gravity isn't really strong enough to hold on to helium. If you pop a helium balloon, ooh, the helium in it, it's going to space. Anyway, the sun has these storms, and it also has an 11-year cycle where every 11 years it reaches a peak. And if you use a telescope to look at the sun, always with the filter, of course, you can see spots on it. And a lot of people think, why are there dark spots on the sun? And I always have to say, they're not dark. They're just not as bright as the stuff around them. They're still very bright, but they look dark compared to everything else. Those spots are where the storms are going on and where the stuff might get spit out. And every 11 years, we reach a time when there are spots on the sun every day. But then five and a half years later, the sun's surface can go for months with no spots on it.
So where are we in this 11-year cycle right now?
This is a weird one. It wasn't as steady. And the peak, we are in the peak, and it's lasted longer than they typically do. And most people thought we were on our way out, and then we've had these major bursts lately. And they can happen at any time, and they can be bad. They harm satellites. There's a website called spaceweather.com, which if you go to it, it's got a lot of current information about what's going on up above the Earth. And, we can have these solar storms anytime, and there are even satellites up there now that can go into safe mode, and even the International Space Station and stuff with that solar storm last week.
Yeah.
They had to, I believe the Russian astronauts on it, they moved them to a different part of it just to give them more protection from the radiation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Let's go to your questions now with our guest, Paul Kinzer, longtime amateur astronomer and author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Let's start with Clint and Nina. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was actually calling in because I had seen some terminology thrown around for some of these objects that are passing through our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd seen them calling them interstellar interlopers.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess my problem with that is it makes it sound as though we or our star somehow owns the space we exist in.
Yeah, yeah. Interloper.
Like interloper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it. I am more conscious of this, but when people anthropomorphize not just scientific objects, but science itself sometimes, so when they say, like, evolution invented, evolution doesn't have, it doesn't have agency, it doesn't invent things, or this species figured out a way. No.
Yeah,
I agree with you. Interloper is a bad one. They are interstellar, but it's not like they're going, I'm coming in anyway. I agree with you.
What's a better way to think about that, Paul?
Just interstellar object.
As we are all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
we are all sort of flowing through this thing, and sometimes...
Maybe a non-solar object, because everything that is part of the solar system is part of the solar system because of the gravity of the sun and the fact that we pretty much all formed together 4.5 billion years ago. So something coming from somewhere else is really exciting, but the exciting part of it isn't, ooh, is it aliens? It's we've never seen these things before. Does it have the same amount of elements in the same proportions as asteroids in the solar system? And if it doesn't, why? You know, that's cool. And we're going to be able to study that in the coming years as we develop even more the technology we have. I mean, this thing was found by, it's called ATLAS because it was found by a robotic telescope that's scanning the skies looking for things. Used to be comets were all found by humans looking through telescopes.
Right.
That almost never happens now, because one of these robotic telescopes spots it first.
So when you see a comet, Halley gets to name the comet, but when the telescope finds it, the telescope gets the name.
Exactly.
Hence 3i Atlas.
Yeah, that's right.
Makes a lot of sense. Clint, thank you for the call. We'll go to Lynn in Westby next. Lynn, good afternoon.
Hi. I was listening to your first part of your program and about settling on Mars. Isn't that a very harsh environment? How could we... at all consider that we could settle there?
And yet there is a lot of focus and funding for the possibility of colonizing Mars, Paul.
Yeah. I say this, but I didn't say it first. You want to settle Mars, first try settling Antarctica. Try finding a way to live on Antarctica, not supplied by airplanes coming in every few weeks, but on your own. It'd be way easier because it's right there. It's way close. You can get there in a couple hours. And you can breathe the air. There is no air on Mars. The Martian surface would kill you very quickly. And I, as a kid, grew up at that time. I was born when lots of scientists still hoped. They didn't really believe it, but they thought, you know, even Carl Sagan, he's like, we need to go to Mars just to know. And then when the satellite sent back pictures of huge asteroid craters, everyone who knew science went, well, there can't be advanced life on a planet that's covered with those, because the atmosphere like ours would have washed them away. And they were, no way. But I grew up in that time when we still thought that. Well, we don't think that anymore. And yet some people don't want to let go of their dreams. And unfortunately, I think there are a lot of people who have this idea that, oh, if only I could go live on Mars, I could get away from all the problems on Earth. Well,
if you bring any people with you, I'm afraid you might be bringing the problems with you. We happen to be central to the issues.
Yes. So I think it's... In my own opinion, it's ridiculous. But
what about the aspirational aspect? And that's something we talked about last hour, that it may be ridiculous, but it also may lead to the next generation and something that would be fathomable and not so out of bounds.
I totally see that. Again, I loved science fiction. Nobody wants to live in the world of Star Trek more than me. But, getting to another star is a whole nother thing, and there are people aspiring to do that. And there, the speed of light gets in your way. But then there are people, theoretical scientists, go, well, there might be ways around that. And they talk about them. And that leads not just maybe someday to Star Trek. It leads to new understanding of how the universe works. So, yeah, there's often unforeseen benefits from these kinds of aspirations. I would just like us to have, because there are so many real things we can aspire to, and those aren't necessarily getting the funding they ought to. They're, you know,
or the focus.
Right. Why is NASA pushing so hard to go to Mars with humans? That's a legitimate question. If you said to me, Paul, will you get to go? I go, okay, then go. Let's do it. Yeah, I'll do that. I'd love to go to Mars. I'd love to go to the moon. I always have wanted to because it would be cool.
Yes.
But long term, if we're talking about getting minerals, then we should be going to asteroids because we don't have to worry about gravity. We don't have to worry about getting up and down from the place.
So if we were to mine something, it wouldn't be the moon or Mars.
No.
It would more likely be an asteroid.
Yeah, and this might get more attention soon because there is actually a NASA probe right now. It's called Psyche. There's an asteroid called Psyche, and we believe it's mostly made of metal.
Hmm.
Most of them are rock, or primarily rock. This one, because it's clearly really massive for how big it is, most people think it's mostly made of metal. That probe is going to get there in a few years, and maybe we will go, holy moly, I don't know, it's made of solid gold. No, it won't be that, but there could
rare
be.
Rare earth metals have become a central topic of international debate, of foreign trade and policy, and if we had a big asteroid that was just all rare earth metals, it would change the debate here on Earth pretty quickly.
And people have talked about this for decades. You know, and then other people will go, oh, how could you mine an asteroid hundreds of millions
Great
of miles
question.
Away?
Great question.
With nuclear bombs, knock a chunk off and then have that chunk push it towards the Earth and put it in orbit.
Carefully.
Yeah. Well, and that gets into stuff too. But yeah, I mean, these ideas, I think, are more sensible.
I love it. I've got an email here from John in Eau Claire, speaking of our interstellar interlopers. He wants to know where comets get their energy from and how they're able to travel long distances through space.
We believe that most comets that come to Earth come from a thing called the Oort cloud, O-O-R-T, named for a scientist, that was his last name, who he predicted, and evidence since then seems to show that he was right, that there, when the solar system formed, the sun blew away a lot of the dust and small things that are in our inner solar system, and that way out away from the sun, but still kind of part of the solar system because the sun's gravity is what's holding it there, is this huge, way bigger than the part of the solar system we live in, cloud of comets.
The Oort cloud.
The Oort cloud. And every once in a while, who knows, some kind of ripple goes through that cloud. One comet pushes too near another one, and the sun's gravity just grabs it. And then probably thousands of years later, the closer it gets to the sun, the faster it goes, and zing, it comes through. And how it comes through, the path it follows, scientists are able to figure out that path, and they can figure out how far away did that thing come from. Did it come from way out in the solar system? Or like these three objects we found, did it come from another star? And that path is what has shown them, yeah, these three things, they're not from here.
Michael emailed to say that for the sake of any life on other planets, he hopes we never find them.
Well, NASA is being extremely careful on any probe now that's going anywhere where they think there's even the tiniest chance of life.
Really?
To really sterilize them. And they didn't do that all the time.
So that we don't end up giving smallpox to another planet.
Well, or wiping out everything there with our own bacteria. Or later coming and going, look, we found life, when it turns out, no, that's life from Earth.
Michael goes on to say, what was one of the first things we did on the moon? We littered.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Our guest is Paul Kinzer from the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, author of Stargazing Basics, and answering your interstellar questions today at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Our conversation continues. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we take a look at what your plants need to prepare for winter with Diana Alfith, retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. And we'll also meet the man who wrote the book on the chainsaw. James Carr joins us with looks at his new book, Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. All coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. Garden Talk every Friday from 11 to 1 here on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is Paul Kinzer, amateur astronomer extraordinaire, and we've been taking a look at our night skies and what we can see out there. And Paul, you were just mentioning to me that if there is life on our moon, it may be because one nation actually accidentally put it there.
That's right. A couple of years ago, Israel, they aspire to have a space program, and there's national pride involved, and lots of nations now, because we can make smaller robotic landers. Not too expensively. I mean, Apollo cost gazillions of dollars, and now we can do it for only one gazillion or whatever. But they sent a probe there, and it was their first. But on board that probe, they had some tardigrades. And if you don't know what they are, they're sometimes called moss pigs or water bears.
These little microscopic.
They can get up to a millimeter across. So some of them you can actually see with your naked eye, but they're fascinating. Look them up. In fact, the screensaver, if we need those anymore, on my laptop at home, it's a tardigrade. They're very, very interesting.
You've seen them before. I know most folks have seen the pictures of them. They just wouldn't realize that that's a microscopic little being and it's now on the moon.
Yeah, because what happened was these little tiny critters, they sent them there and they were going to study them. But unfortunately, their spaceship crashed. And we don't know. It may be that the tardigrades burned up, but tardigrades go into stasis. They go into a sort of suspended animation, and they put some of them on the outside of the International Space Station for quite a long time. They took them back in. They poured some water on them. They went, "Hey, how's it going?"
And they're back.
They're back. So, yeah,
there might be life on the moon right now.
And it's got eight legs, and each of those legs have really sharp little claws on them. And
they're going to be hard to find.
They look like something somebody made up. Yeah.
And yet it's a very real story of Israel's trip to the moon and the tardigrades that are now potentially there. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of emails I want to make sure we get to. Todd in Sauk City couldn't stay with us. He said that at the school where he used to teach, he and his students would spread a plastic sheet on the roof of the school and leave it there all year. The students would then examine the sheet and find micrometeorite material that settled on it. Paul, have you heard of an experiment like this? Could any of us do this?
Yes, and you don't need to put a sheet on your roof. If you have a roof and it has gutters, that your roof slowly, everything washes down.
Yeah.
And if you take some of that stuff from the gutter, and you know what you're doing, you look under a microscope, yep. And it all started because there was some fellow, I don't think he was a scientist, and he said, "I think this is true." And he said, "I want to see if that's true."
He's got a hypothesis. He tests a hypothesis. It's a scientific method.
Right. We know that the Earth is bombarded with micrometeorites every second, all the time. And he was scoffed at by local researchers, I think. So he did some and took them to somebody who would know what they were doing. They looked in a microscope, and about 10% of that, micrometeorites.
Paul Kinzer, are you telling me that there is stardust in my gutters?
Yes, and and it's also true that you are stardust. All the iron and things like that in our bodies, the only way to create them is in a supernova.
Well,
so the iron in your body was once inside a star.
Now you're making me think it's we who are the aliens,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah.
Let's go to Gary in Strum this afternoon. Gary, good afternoon.
My question is that we know the sun is what makes the Earth happen. How far out does the sun have enough power to make that happen on another planet?
Interesting, because we talked about the water on Saturn's moons.
Yeah.
But does the sun have the ability to create life on other planets or moons?
Well, the heat of the sun, the radiation of the sun could provide the energy needed for living things. But I took the question a little wider, the influence of the sun with that solar wind, and then with its gravity. Gravity, you know, it fades and fades and fades. I mean, you could say this: the gravity of the sun affects things across the universe, I guess. But the Voyager probes that were sent up in the 1970s, people said they are one day going to reach the edge of the solar system. And it's like, well, that depends on what you mean by the edge. But one definition is when you get so far out that that solar wind is pushed back by the interstellar cosmic radiation.
Oh.
And one of them has reached that point.
Oh.
And it's far away. It's much, much farther than Pluto. So, yeah. And we know there are asteroids that go out way farther than Pluto, like 40, 50 times farther. But then thousands of years later, they come zipping back in their orbits around. Comets do that too. But, yeah. So
I hear you counting Pluto as a planet.
Oh yeah, Pluto's a planet.
If you say
so. I got Neil deGrasse Tyson to admit that. I talked to him on the phone, and he said, "Okay, fine, it's a planet, but it's a dwarf planet." And I'm like,
put a caveat at the end of
if it
has been up for debate, hasn't it?
Yeah, and if it goes around the sun, and it's big enough that gravity made it round, it's a planet.
There you go.
I mean, that is the definition. Many people use, and the argument that it's not a planet, you know, then is Earth a planet because it's so much smaller than Jupiter? I don't know.
Gary, does that help answer your question?
It does. Hey. So why wouldn't they look for another sun?
Yeah. We do look for other suns, though, don't we? We look for the third rock from the sun on stars all over
galaxy. We have found planets now around confirmed planets around at least 5,000 other stars. And we can do that now because our telescopes and computers are sensitive enough to see the star wobble. When a planet, like when Jupiter goes around the sun, it makes the sun wobble.
Because of its gravitational force.
That's right. And we have found thousands of them.
Wow. You mentioned the Voyager. Tim up north called to ask if we have received any knowledge. Are we receiving any useful info from the Voyager these days that could help us advance space travel?
I don't know about the advanced space travel other than, you know, they're still able to signal back.
Yeah.
They're still able to stay in touch with them. So that right there is important. How far out can we easily communicate with spacecraft?
Mm-hmm.
And those spacecraft, you know, they're a lot of it is 1960s technology because they were launched in the mid-1970s. I mean, they have tape recorders on them.
Commodore 64 is up in space.
That's probably more advanced than they were or close.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, Paul Kinzer, as we're wrapping up here, what can we see in our night skies coming up here? What should we be looking for across Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's kind of cool. We've taken this long to get to that. That's usually what I talk about the most. Well, the nights are long now. You can go outside right after supper, and it's dark. It's cold, too, but, you know, it's dark.
But that makes the skies clear, doesn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. So I'll just talk a little bit about what's up in the sky in the winter, because, you know, you might not be able to go out tonight. Saturn, if you go outside right when it gets dark, look in the east, and you'll see a fairly bright yellowish star. But if you aim a telescope at it, you'll see that it's shaped like a ball. No star, even in the biggest telescope, is anything more than a point of light. Well, okay, there's a couple of stars that in the biggest telescopes might, but... So it's a little ball, and there's a line going through it, just this little line. Well, that's Saturn, and much of the time, you can see an oval ring going around it, but right now, it's at a place in its orbit where the rings have closed up. They open up over 15 years as the seasons go by, because just like the Earth, it's tilted. So as it goes around the sun, to us, they open up. And then they close after 15 years, but then they open up the other way because Saturn takes about 30 years to go around the sun.
Ooh.
You can also see one of its moons through a small telescope, not binoculars, but a small telescope. That moon is Titan, and NASA landed a European satellite on that moon in 2004 called Huygens. And Huygens was a European scientist hundreds of years ago. And it parachuted through the thick atmosphere of that moon, thicker than Earth's atmosphere. Not oxygen, though. It's natural gas, basically, I think. And it landed. And Cassini itself, the satellite, that the probe that it came off of, took pictures over decades of that moon, and there are seas, lakes, rivers. But again, it's not water. It's frozen natural gas or something. And there's now a plan to send a helicopter there.
A helicopter?
Yeah, because they can fly. This moon has way less gravity than Earth and a thicker atmosphere.
Sure.
So if you can make a helicopter fly on Mars, which they did, whose atmosphere is only 1% of Earth's, well, it's pretty darn easy to get it to fly on a moon that is smaller than Mars and has an atmosphere thicker than Earth. I can't wait for that.
And so we can see Saturn in our skies today.
Yes. And if you wait a little later at night or a little later in the season, Jupiter will be rising.
Whoa.
Jupiter right now, it's coming up. Let's see. Yeah, it's coming up around 8:30 right now. It's rising, so by 9:30.
Nice and dark at 8:30.
9:30, you can't mistake Jupiter. It'll be the brightest thing in the sky.
And again, it'll be a ball.
Yeah, if you through binoculars, you can see the ball of Jupiter and four of its moons.
What?
And there are probes on their way to those four moons right now.
Where in the sky will I be looking for Saturn and Jupiter?
Right now, Saturn is pretty much in the south, right when
south?
It gets dark.
Okay.
And it's maybe, you know, hold both your fists out at arm's length and then do it again.
Okay.
And that's probably where it'll be.
Okay.
And Jupiter, just look in the east. If you have a clear horizon, 8:30, but if you don't, 9:30, 10 o'clock.
Any meteor showers coming our way?
Yes, the Geminid meteor shower, one of the most dependable of the year. You might see 120 meteors in an hour.
Oh.
And that is peaking on, let me look at my notes here. I don't want to make a mistake.
Is this an annual event?
Yes, every December, mid-December, and this year it's the night of the 13th and the 14th. We pass through the debris left by a comet. And as we pass through that debris, the little bits of stuff the comet left behind slam into the Earth's atmosphere. Almost all meteors you see are grains of sand. If you see a super bright one, it might be, you know, a small pebble. Now, there was one about as big as, a bread box that blew up over Viroqua maybe 10 years ago now. People heard it blow up.
But it was just a bread box.
Yeah, well, there was one that blew up over a city in Russia in 2013 about the size of a school bus. If it had been coming in at a steep angle, it might have killed a million people.
Whoa.
But because it came in at a narrow angle, it blew up in the upper atmosphere.
Right.
It knocked out thousands of windows.
But most of them burn off in
the atmosphere. Yeah, they're just little
things.
Most
of them are smaller than a bread box.
Right, and they zip through in a second. Yeah. And so that's a great night to go out. And this year especially, because this year there's no moon in the sky.
December 13th and 14th?
Yeah, no moon. So if it's clear out, and especially if you can get away from town, you don't want binoculars or a telescope because you don't know where they're going to be in
right?
the sky. And they come out of Gemini. They look like they're coming out of the constellation Gemini, which is where Jupiter is.
Oh!
Yeah, it's pretty cool this year.
All coming up December 13th and 14th in your night skies across Wisconsin.
And the shower starts before then. You're more likely to see way more meteors a few nights before and after as well.
Oh, man. Something to look forward to in our night skies. And Paul Kinzer, it is always a pleasure. You make us see the world a little bit differently. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, I love coming.
It's been fun. Paul's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, also a longtime member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, and he shall return with us here on the Larry Mueller Show. A big thanks to the team that makes it all possible, makes it fun and easy for me. Thank to Clara Neipert, Joel Patinaud, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and of course, our own Larry Mueller. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Stay tuned, lots more in store here on WPR News.
The sun is a mass of incandescent.